Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Another week of financial education. Here we go. Ryan, what's up, man?
Not much. We have this common request, which is, Ryan, you and Tate talk about all these things on the show, but I don't know who to hire to advise me on all of them. And so we're going to try to give you some help there today. We also, how do you find operators? How do you vet them? How do you know that a good deal is a good deal? We're going to go into that.
How do you understand risk profile? Like what makes a deal risky versus not risky? We're going to go into all that and how to do it with a self-directed retirement account.
That's right. Yeah. And we're going to bring on the one, the only Matt Sorensen, who opens up thousands of accounts every month. And he sees these types of deals come in. He knows the operators in the space. And I think it's going to be a really great opportunity for those that want to learn how to diversify into alternative assets like real estate, syndications, do it with their retirement account, and also do it in the right way.
Absolutely.
If you missed our last episode, Matt Sorensen, he was on episode 124, where we talked about retirement account investing. We've also had prior episodes on how to set up a self-directed IRA. So encourage you to look backwards, find those episodes.
Definitely. We've had IRA Club on episode 110. That was a great one. We've done episode 36 and episode 9. If you want to go back to some of the legacy episodes, we talked about it there as well. So lots of resources in terms of talking about how these accounts work, how they differ from public market IRAs, but really, really compelling conversation. So let's get to the show.
Let's do it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Matt, it was so great seeing you down in Scottsdale at the Directed IRA Summit. It was called the Alternative Investing Summit, and it was just really fun catching up with you, meeting your team, seeing how great of an event you put on. And but anyway, so happy to have you back on. Welcome.
Yeah, it's an honor to be on again two times. I guess I didn't screw up last time, so
yeah, it wasn't bad. Wasn't bad.
Yeah, we did have one hell of an event. Ryan got on stage, did an excellent job talking about an asset class a lot of our investors and audience doesn't hear much about. So it was awesome. And, you know, we're always doing those, of course, but we're all about education. And maybe that's what we'll talk about today. You know, who knows? We'll see.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I really appreciated about the event was the variety of the speakers you had. But I loved how, you know, you obviously are super knowledgeable about self-directed IRA investing, having your own company. A lot of our clients use directed IRA. The thing that I love, though, is that you and Mark Kohler have seen so many different operators in investment opportunities in your tenure, because you're a custodian, so you're kind of seeing this stuff kind of come in. And, you know, can you kind of explain the, you know, before we get into this a little bit, like, what is the role of an IRA custodian with vetting investments?
Yeah.
Or do they not invest investments?
If I can lend some color, if you're just tuning in, if this is maybe the first episode you've listened to, obviously, Matt Sorensen, Directed IRA. Directed IRA is a custodian, a self-directed IRA custodian that allows you to invest in alternative assets. So usually, if you're with a Fidelity or a Schwab or a TD Ameritrade, you're only going to have access to the public markets. And so your event was called, it was the
Alternative Asset Summit, yeah.
Alternative Asset Summit, thank you. And essentially, a few days of talking only about private market alternative investments, which of course is what my firm does, is what Ryan's firm does, and Matt Sorensen here, Directed IRA, they are a custodian that allows you to invest in these types of things through a retirement account, through a tax advantage vehicle.
Yeah, Tate, I'm glad you gave the context, because I think a lot of people think that they're like a Fidelity where there's an advisor there or a wealth manager that's going to help you make investment selections. And I think that's the pro and the con, right? It's like the pro is you get these private markets, these niche alternatives.
Yeah.
But then maybe a drawback would be they're not picking these investments for you. They're not actually going to like vet them. You know, maybe there's some compliance stuff, but I was going to kind of let Matt speak to that. You know, like, what's your role in the investment? Yeah.
It's like dinner en blanc.
Yes.
Yeah. It's, I mean, this is a, this is really important, because we'll talk about like due diligence and how to look and analyze an investment. But the first thing to know is that's not your IRA custodian's job. So when you have a self-directed IRA, you're basically saying, I'm making decisions for this. I don't have an advisor. And some of our clients do have an advisor they appoint separately, but that's not us. And so we let your IRA invest into whatever you want. Good ideas, bad ideas. We don't know. That's not our expertise. And you're not paying us for that, you know? And I've had lots of clients invest in stuff. I'm like, that sounds dumb. And they make a lot of money. And then every once in a while, they'll invest in stuff that I'm like, that sounds dumb. And it was. So it's not our role. And frankly, it's not necessarily what we're good at. And I'll just give you one stat that I find is interesting too. And this is in my presentation that I gave at the event, is 62% of high net worth clients that have an advisor don't use their advisor when investing in alternative assets.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That's high.
Like, these are people that have an advisor already. They don't even use them when they're doing these investments that are not, you know, publicly traded. So it is kind of on you as you're vetting these investments, making decisions about where you want to invest. There can be greater risks, but also greater return. Of course, that's the promise of it and why you might be doing that. And we can help break that down. But yeah, not the IRA custodian's job.
Why do you think they don't use their advisor? That's interesting.
One, because their advisor will probably try to talk them out of it, you know?
Right.
It's just like, I don't know if you've seen this, but like there's a clip of Jeff Bezos talking about, you know, he was selling, he raised money for Amazon, right? And I think he got, he sold 20% of Amazon for like $5 million. All right.
Right.
And I think you put in like 100K or something and you need like $1 million. All right. And it was obviously an insane opportunity, but you know, every advisor, if anybody took that idea to their advisor, every advisor would have been like, nope,
yeah,
sounds risky. This guy's selling books online. You can just go to a bookstore, bro. You know what I mean? It's yeah. Like, you know, and seriously, just think of that.
It's such a good point.
Yeah.
It's such a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same. And advisors, they don't want the risk of you losing. And so they want to put you into something where you just, you may not make a lot, but you're not going to lose a lot. And that's where they win really in the long game, where they're charging assets under management. They're not getting a piece of if you do exceptionally well. So, and they are worried about liability and risks, and they have compliance offices that have to approve these things. And it's just really, it's an administrative headache, frankly.
Can you tell me about the 38% of those that actually would give them advice or look at the deal? Like, who are those types of advisors? Because a lot of pilots ask us,
yeah,
you know, hey, I want an advisor to sort of help me put all this stuff together, but then not every advisor focuses on privates and alternative investments. So what types of people are those, do you think?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, we have a number of clients, you know, even we had one that spoke at the event, has 100 million plus Roth IRA. We have lots of clients with 10 million plus. A couple of them spoke to at our closed door customer appreciation event. It's funny. All of those clients, they don't even have advisors themselves. They'll use them to get like advice, but they don't like manage the money and make the investment decisions. These guys all do it for themselves. We do have some ultra net worth clients, and I run into even our law firm practice, you know. But it's interesting if you're like, you have like $1 million net worth or a couple million bucks. Most advisors are like, they just want to put that in the market. They do not want to put it in alternatives. Maybe they'll let you play with 100 grand or something. A number of advisors kind of have like, they won't let you do more than 20% or 30% in alternatives. It's just like a policy thing that they have. But what you see is once you get to people like really wealthy, you know, let's say like ultra high net worth, 25 million plus, the vast majority of their wealth, and I have a stat that I do on my deck, you know, ultra high net worth individuals have 83% of their assets in private assets and alternatives. And it's just because they can build the team. They'll have the professionals that'll go do this work. But if you're paying like a typical, I hate to say it, but like a Edward Jones advisor or someone who's like at Northwestern Mutual or New York Life, that's job's really to sell you insurance products. They say they're in wealth management, you know, or they work for a broker dealer, you know, think about like, they kind of let you invest in what they sell. I hate to say it. Is they just don't want you to do that.
Yeah.
They just don't want you to. It's more work. They're disincentivized from the companies they work at that employ them to let you do it. And so you really need the ones that have a lot more independence. These would be like the RIAs and stuff. But even the RIAs we run into, like, you know, a lot of them won't let them go more than 20 to 30%. for a client unless they're like ultra high net worth.
This is a wonderful conversation because it oftentimes is an elephant in the room when somebody starts to learn a little bit more about this. I know this podcast has been a huge eye-opener for a lot of our listeners that are starting to get more sophisticated, understand the alternatives, and then all of a sudden they're getting pushback from a financial advisor that they have, and they're going, hang on, am I getting duped? Is this riskier than I think it is? So I think this provides a really great context. So I'm excited to get into performing due diligence because you said that is not the custodian's job, understandably. But you said something interesting that I want to go back to. You said, you know, you pay as a client of Directed IRA, you don't have to pay a fee for Fidelity or Schwab. And most people listening to this show understand that when you go to a self-directed custodian, it's fee-based because you're not making money on trading fees and things like that. What are they paying you for? Because we do have a lot of pushback sometimes when somebody goes, oh my God, it's like this much to start the account and this much per transaction sometimes or an annual fee. What are people paying the self-directed custodian to do?
Yeah, well, the first thing is you have to have a custodian. So you have to have someone that's a bank, a credit union, or a trust company that's going to hold custody of your assets, track all the income, your contributions, your distributions, your conversions, income out, you know, expense out, investments. So you have to have a custodian, and they're doing those functions. They're processing the paperwork. They're holding the records. It's subject to audit. You know, we have outside audits with two CPA firms every year. We have an audit with the banking department every year where we're licensed and regulated. So it's like a regulated space. Also, we're reporting to the IRS every year. You have called a 5498. We have to report to the IRS every year that we do for you. You don't have to put it on your tax return unless you took a distribution or something like that. You get a 1099. And so, but we're doing all that tax reporting as well. And you know, you're getting statements and have service and all that type of stuff. So that's what you're paying with the self-directed custodian. The reason you pay though a self-directed custodian is because we don't make money on what you're investing.
Right.
Right. So we have to charge you a fee to do the work. We're not getting a kickback because you invested in something, or we're not getting payment for order flow, which most, you know, IRA providers get. They're getting paid in the trading volume. As the money's going through. So when you think you bought something for, you know, $10 a share, you bought it for $9.80 actually. There's a 20% cut that went to your IRA custodian, as an example. It's called payment for order flow. So that's how we're getting paid. But it's, you know, if you go to like, I ran across like UBS or some of these like, you know, typical wealth management providers, they do self-directed IRAs if you're ultra high net worth and your advisor's charging you 1%.
Right.
You know, also think of the average 401k. The average 401k in America charges 1.5%. If you got a $100,000 account, you're paying $1,500 a year for that.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's something we don't think about as pilots with multi-million-dollar 401ks, is it?
Yeah. Yeah. Just go. I mean, you can find like what's the cost ratio on your 401k plan, especially if it's a larger one. Like they have to report that to the DOL. It's very rarely under 1%, unless it's a very, very, very big plan. But, you know, that's a significant amount of money. We don't charge a percent. It's just a flat fee that tries to represent the work that we're doing, which is, you know, it's like our standard fee is $495 and it's $50 when you buy or sell. That's what you pay for a self-directed IRA with us.
There we go.
Yeah. And, you know, I think what's interesting too is people ask like what custodian should I use for my IRA? There's so many options. And I always like to go back to like, I really look for two main things when I evaluate, you know, which custodian to use for my self-directed IRA.
Especially because pricing is almost flat across the board. Like everybody's the same.
Yeah, pretty close. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The two things that I talked about this with people in the audience, which is why I like directed IRA, which is one, got to have the brokerage link so that when you invest in a syndication, you get the $50,000 that goes in or the $100,000 that goes into the syndication, you know, through Turbine or Spartan. And then you're going to get these distributions, you know, $400 or $500 every month or whatever it is. And then what do you do with those little pieces of money? Because the minimums are $100,000, $50,000, whatever they are. And so it just kind of sits there. Yeah. And the brokerage link is such an important thing because then you can send that money into the market and it can be still invested even in small increments. But then the second thing that I make sure that the custodian has is some kind of a educational platform. And this is where I think it's interesting, Matt, like, you know, you can't make recommendations, or you can't give investment advice to people or who, what operator to use. You can provide education, though, from my understanding. And so having a conference, having an ecosystem, inviting speakers in, kind of exposing your clients to people that they can invest with, I think is such an important value add.
Yeah.
Where if you're just like an asleep at the wheel custodian and you just collect your fees and there's no brokerage link and it's hard to get in touch with people. I mean, obviously customer service is a big part of that. And, you know, of course you've got to have good customer service, but those are kind of the two, I think, really kind of distinguishing factors in my opinion that really make what you guys do awesome.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And yeah, and I'll just say on the education part, just so people know, is like, we do a webinar like every other week. We have a podcast episode every week on the Direct Diary podcast. We do two annual events a year that are specifically around self-directing, let alone our other events on tax and legal planning. I wrote the number one book, the Self-Directed IRA Handbook, that government regulators buy, every competitor in our industry buys. It really is like the number one book in the field. So like, we've done a lot of the work to just try to make it easy for you to get educated. And I'll say this too, like, self-directing isn't for everyone. You know, you might be like, well, Matt, why don't I just buy the S&P 500? Cool. I'm not saying don't do that.
Right.
I'm just saying a lot of people run across other investment opportunities, and the best bucket they have to invest in is these retirement account funds, particularly in private assets that are long time duration. They're illiquid. Well, so is your IRA or 401k. You can't touch till you're 59 and a half. And it's like a great mix of using the IRA in private assets, and you're just not able to get that at the typical Fidelity or, you know, typical broker dealer. So we feel like it's for way more people than are currently utilizing, even though it's not for everybody. And so we do like people who, but if someone's entrepreneurial, they're, you know, smarter professional type people we see a lot. And then other people that are just like, I'm just like over invested in the stock market. Like, my whole net worth is in the stock market.
That's our audience. Yeah. Our audience gets, you know, $60,000 a year stuffed into their 401k, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But they have no exposure to alternative assets. They can't invest their retirement dollars in real estate. And so for pilots that flew at a regional or flew in the military,
yep,
and have a TSP, they can roll that kind of stuff into a self-directed IRA that you guys provide.
Yep.
That now allows them to invest in a syndication, things like that, and get a little bit of diversification away from just having your whole nest egg be in a 401k without any, you know, certain distributions or whatever. Or maybe it does, but you know, your limited exposure to traditional investing. That's what we're talking about today. But I did want to transition because I know you've seen a lot of balls go across the plate.
Yeah, and I have a great analogy for this. If anybody's familiar with Dinner en Blanc, if I can go back to this, I love this, because Dinner en Blanc is this event that an organization puts on, and you have to like get on a wait list, and it's really hard to get tickets. And they do these secret pop-ups where they have dinner and everybody wears white and they have, you know, white tablecloths, and they set the thing up. But you have to bring, it's so funny because you pay to go and there's the table. No, there isn't even the table. I'm sorry. You have to bring the table. You have to bring your food. So I think this is a great analogy for SDIRAs, right? Because you are the structure, you're the infrastructure, but it's like, we don't have control over whether your food sucks or not, right? You can bring a great deal or you can bring a terrible deal. So let's get into how to bring great food to the dinner party.
Exactly. And I think some people have been dying for that, right? Like they see investment opportunity and they see whether, you know, I mean, this is like, I just always give the example of like, invest in what you know, and if we want to get returns in our retirement account, a lot of people see these opportunities. Like, we had a big group of dentists invest in a mouth guard thing, you know?
Right.
I mean, they're in people's mouths all day. So they're like investing in something that they know. And a lot of them use their IRAs, you know? And so that's just a quick example to be like, well, how do I do that? And I want to use retirement account dollars where I'm fine tying that up for the next 10 years or so. And so, but it is up to you and what you want to bring based on the deals and opportunities that you see and what you have conviction and believe in. And one of the biggest problems, I think, with the stock market, which might be the restaurant industry, is we're all getting the same shit. I hate to say it, but less and less companies are going public. 83% of companies over 100 million in revenue are private. You could,
it's 87.
Only it's 87. 87. There you go. Okay, yep. There you go. It's even worse. See, so you can only invest in 13% of the biggest companies in America that are on the stock market. How crazy is that? We used to have like 7,000 or 8,000 publicly traded companies. We're down like 15 years ago. We're down to like 1600 now. Like it's dwindling. And so these same retirement account dollars are chasing the same companies. And so if you're like, well, how do I get an edge and how do I see other opportunities? And it's not just in public companies. It's like real estate companies that aren't going public. It's, you know, technology companies that aren't going public. It's healthcare and bioscience, biotech, whatever the space is, everybody's going less public. And so how do I use these dollars to get into the private companies that I think have more growth opportunity? And that's where this private asset is. And maybe this is the dinner en blanc, because you got to bring your own damn deals. You got to go find them yourself. The chain restaurants, the New York Stock Exchange share, is going to serve you the same crap they're serving everyone else. That was my best attempt at staying with the analogy.
I love it. Yeah, no, that's it. It's like, you know, you got Chili's and Applebee's, and it's like the same menu.
It'll grow on you.
Yeah.
We don't want to be eating good in the neighborhood too much, you know.
My vetting of an operator has changed over the years, because I've invested in 26 different syndications outside of Spartan. And of course, I do my own deals, but, you know, 26 different ones with LPs, and I've really kind of boiled it down to, and I'd love to hear your top things, right? I think we should transition to that.
Yeah.
But, you know, my story is I went after the deals that had the best returns and the flashiest flash. Those all failed. Those never went well. And then I sort of changed my thinking to, I have to really get to know you. I have to know who you are. I have to like you and trust you as a person. But I know a lot of people, like I trust and like my neighbor, but that doesn't make them a good real estate operator. So like and trust is important, but then it's kind of like, what is their experience? And then, but they could be highly experienced, but not know how to run a team. So then I kind of like, now it's like a layer down into who's on your team and what operational experience do they have in the industry? And then like reputation. So those are kind of what I've gone to. I mean, just keeping things like high level. I'd love to hear your philosophy on how you meet people, vet them, kind of get to better understand an opportunity, you know, overall. Cause I've invested with very untrustworthy people who had a really great underwriting file. You know, it was good underwriting file and it had good projections, but they're a bad person. So the whole thing collapsed.
Yeah. I would say point number one on my list is, if you don't understand, do not invest. And that seems like pretty simple, but that's pretty much everything. I hate to say it.
Yeah.
And so let me hit into a couple of things there. I'll just I won't say the name of the word I invested into, but I just said, you know, it's like a multifamily real estate deal that I invested quite a bit of money into myself with my IRA and even some personal funds. It's like, if I think about this, is like, there's so many multifamily funds out there. I hate to say it. We see them here every day. I mean, just keep in mind, we have between 500 and 1,000 new accounts a month here. And they're investing all in a private asset, about one third of them investing into a private fund. So like, you can just do the math on how many deals are coming out every day. So I see a lot of stuff, and I'm of course very interested in that. I've been a business and tax lawyer for 20 years too, helping clients, you know, a lot of business owners that are investing into privates, they're entrepreneurial, they love that stuff. And so I've had like pretty good, like, a good survey of like what's happening here. So like on the multifamily fund, I was kind of like, do I really want to invest in multifamily? It seems oversaturated. Everyone's chasing it. Rates are up. A lot of operators are dying on the vine. But there's a few things I looked at with this operator. One is like, how are they buying properties right now? They're buying everything distressed right now. And a lot of people are like, well, we buy distressed assets. Okay, how are you going to execute on that? Everyone's trying to buy distressed. Well, these guys have a strategy on how they buy distressed. One of the partners happens to be the number one broker in like the Southwest region for multifamily real estate. Like the guy's been in the mix for 25 years. He knows everybody. He sold half of the multifamily properties that are now in foreclosure. You know what I mean? And so like, okay, so I know they're going to have deal flow. And then it's like, all right, how are they going to operate these properties? Well, we've figured out how to in-house some things. You know, we're in-housing construction and property management, and these people actually have some equity in the company, you know? And so like, I've just learned over time, and this is just like for whether it's a business or an investment vehicle, is like a lot of this alignment, expertise, background, people say, well, look into the background of who you're investing into. No, I mean, really, like tie that background out to what they're trying to execute on, you know? I don't want someone who's been like an executive at, you know, Apple to go into the real estate space necessarily and be like, I'm like, what's that? Maybe you know how to manage people or a project or something, but like, what's your expertise? Like, what's your edge? So when I'm like trying to understand the investment, I'm always being like, what's your edge? I need to know, what do you have that's going to differentiate yourself from everyone else that competes in your space? And you could say this about anything, tech, storage, multifamily, retail, real estate. I don't care what the strategy is, right? So I want to know what's your edge. And then once I understand like your angle and how you're going to make money and beat the competition, then I want to know like, what are the people behind this? Track record obviously is important, but like, what's their experience? Who is this person? Are they smart? Can they lead people? You know, whatever that may be. And then we'll get into some of the other things, but that's the first thing is I'm trying to understand, like, do these people know what they're doing? Like, what is their thesis on this? Does it make sense to me? I don't want to be talked into something. I want to be like, this needs to make sense to me. And then can they actually execute on it? And I think a lot of people, particularly in syndications, take that for granted, that like, they might be like, yeah, we're going to raise money for real estate. Okay. Do they have like a big social media presence? Cool. But do they really, can they execute on that? They could probably raise the money, but can they execute on that? Or are they going to get their ass handed to them?
Sometimes I even get a little skeptical when the social media presence is too big.
Oh yeah, totally.
You're almost like,
yes. Yeah.
So are you an influencer or are you a real estate operator?
Exactly.
There's a huge difference. I mean, I'll be perfectly honest. Like, people have like, Ryan, why haven't you started masterminds and taught courses and done these things? And I'm like, I don't know how a guy who's got 43,000 units has time to teach newbies on how to do sell, like, and collect a fee. And it's like, I don't have time for that.
I know. And that's like that. I don't say it's a red flag, but it's a yellow flag. You know, it's a caution. Yeah. And like, did they get into real estate because they had a big social following, or were they good at real estate or whatever the thing is they're doing, and they got a good social following after? Totally. You know, and because I'm going to make money based on your ability to execute on the investment I invested in, whatever that strategy might have been. So I want to really understand it, and I'll challenge a lot. I mean, this is back when I was a lawyer. I would kind of help clients on due diligence, you know, and I'd be like, explain to me how this makes money. And you'd be surprised how many people are like, well, they just say it does. They just, here's the pro forma. I mean, look at this number at the end. I'm like, yeah, but how do they get there?
Yeah.
Well, I need to know that. I mean, I'm like, how long did it take you to make that 100 grand?
Yeah.
You're going to take 15 minutes and get all hyped up and invest it. Let's take a little more time. It took you a long time to make that 100 grand before you go invest it.
Absolutely. What are your thoughts on scars? Deals going not so well, you know, because this is a big one for me is, you know, as pilots, you go through your career and you don't learn a ton on those blue sky days where everything works perfectly. You learn a lot when the weather's bad and there's a bunch of crew resource management issues and, you know, there's ATC delays and you've got fuel to think about. You land on those flights, even with or without a mechanical issue, and you inevitably go to the bar and debrief and you're like, wow, I learned a lot there.
Yeah.
And you take that into, whether it's in the simulator or the real airplane, you take that into your wisdom. And I think that's why people tend to gravitate, you know, they're like, I want a pilot with gray hair. It's like, well, the quality of the experience matters as well. It's not just about time in the seat. So what are your thoughts on that?
My saying is always, you can have 10,000 hours of experience, or you can have 10,000 hours of experiencing the same hour, right?
Yeah.
It's like going back and forth to the Caribbean, you know, in a blue sky day and the same plane is 10,000 hours of the same hour. It's not actual experience.
Yeah. I think in terms of like vetting an operator, thinking about investing in alternative assets, you know, experience and knowing you're going to have some failures along the way is just like, take that for granted. Like, it's going to happen. If you're investing in alternatives over time, you will have a bad investment. Just like the stock market can go down 20% in a year. All right. There can be some tricky outcomes and one of the deals might not go well, but you have to take this all into account in risk versus return, right? The promise of alternatives in general is it's going to outperform the stock market, right? That's generally 9 out of 10 times. That's the reason you're doing it. you feel like this asset is going to appreciate or have more cash flow than what I could do by pushing a button and investing in the stock market. And so if I believe there's a greater return ratio, the question is like, how much risk am I willing to take? Because sure, like I'm going to have some problems along the way, but if the return outweighs all those risks and I'm going to get better over time in recognizing the return versus the risks, at the end of the day, you become a really good investor once you've been doing this 10 or 20 years. But let's just take like venture, you know? So like, you know, the alt assets, and we talked about gold, venture, private equity, real estate, all the different categories, crypto, you know, and when I presented, I did the hot crazy matrix, the hot crazy matrix, you know.
He does it for the deal. I do it for the investor.
I love that. Yeah.
I do it for the deal, which gets into like due diligence here and like, what should you invest in? Because if you think of like the hot crazy matrix, right, this was a law enforcement group. I forget the whole group, but they, you know, a guy basically gave a lecture to other men about how do you choose a wife. And he goes through like the hotter they are, the crazier they get. And then this is a matrix. All right. And so goes through who you should date, who you should marry. And so I use the same thing, and I used risk versus return, right? The higher return, that's the hot, versus the crazy, that's the risk.
Right.
The higher the hot, the more crazy the more risk we're willing to entertain. Okay. It works the same thing. Okay. So take like venture, for example. You know, if you're investing in startups and venture, the most likely outcome is that company's going to go to zero. It is very high on the risk side of things, but also very high on the return. So if I'm a venture investor, I should be good knowing this could go to zero. But you know what? If I invest in 10 of them and 9 of them go to zero, if one of them goes 100x, I made a lot of money. I 10x the overall investment in that space. Okay.
Absolutely.
And so like crypto could be the same thing, right? Highly risky. It's still like there's a lot of government uncertainty. Who knows when an administration changes? Now, I know we got crypto president now, but who knows if an administration changes? There's lots of things going on there, but there's a lot of promise. So like, but it's high risk, high return. Then you come down to real estate though. A lot of real estate can be good return, but not like it's going to go 10x or 100x, right? This is not like the next Uber, right? But it needs to have a requisite low risk too. And so if I can look at that deal and understand where's the risk in this deal, and I think this is like, and just going back to the very first point of like, do you understand the investment? Like, what are the risk factors of when this deal could go wrong? And I think for most real estate deals in particular, and we just see a lot of real estate actually here. That's probably the number one fund someone invests in is real estate of some variety here at Directed IRA. But the number one risk factor in real estate is debt.
Yep.
Can they properly manage the debt? It's like Warren Buffett said, there's three L's we got to worry about: ladies, liquor, and leverage, you know? And so leverage in the real estate space is what's the killer. So like, they understand the debt. What type of debt are they getting? If I'm looking at a real estate investment play, I really better know how they're using debt.
I've said this on the show before, and Ryan, this is a perfect follow-up question, but I've said this on the show before, but 99 times out of 100, when you hear someone say, oh, I lost all my money in this real estate deal, it's because of debt.
Yeah.
If you had purchased that property all cash, it doesn't matter what happens.
Totally.
You can ride out anything because you don't have a debt service payment to make, and nobody can take that property back from you if you stop paying, except for the government if you don't pay your property taxes, right? But it will probably be cash flowing if it's an existing asset. So that is a huge, if you take one thing away from this due diligence talk, it's that the higher the leverage ratio, the riskier the project. I would say that's a generalization, but Ryan, I'll tee it back up to you because that's a perfect follow-on question.
I just want to make sure like don't like only do deals that don't have debt. I'm not saying what
absolutely.
To do, but I'm just saying that
you get more return.
Yeah. I mean, more debt means with more debt. Return typically, right? Typically. Right. And you know, so I think there's a lot of different ways to look at the risk of debt. You know, Matt, what would you kind of double click into that? Like, what would be, oh, that's a red flag, or that's a yellow, or that's okay. It depends on these other things. Like, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, I just want to know, like, like full disclosure, like what is the debt that you already have on assets if I'm investing into versus the debt if this is new assets you're acquiring? Like what's the strategy there? And so I just want to know because I want to take that into calculation of the risk return matrix, right? Sure, they could be like, we don't use debt at all. Okay, I'm guessing your return's lower than the next deal I could look at that uses debt to leverage and can get me a higher return. But I might say I'm willing to go get a higher return because I think you're being responsible about the amount of debt that you're taking. So clearly, like an adequate amount of debt makes sense in the deals I've invested in, all of them except one, but most, the vast majority of them have debt in them.
Absolutely.
And I'm okay with that because overall they get a better return. But I want to make sure that if there's some pressure testing that needs to happen and like they have a vacancy issue or significant unexpected cost, or maybe they have variable rate interest on the debt. Like those are things I want to know that they have thought about because that's where the deal could fall apart and where I'm not getting checks anymore as an investor, but I'm getting a capital call request to go put money in.
Right.
Because they're upside down on the debt or some expenses that they can't cover.
I think most people fail to also appreciate that this is one of the biggest benefits of a syndication.
Yes.
Because if you go buy a rental property, you are on the hook for that debt. You are personally liable. So, you know, I had a friend who invested years ago who said, hey, you know, I could do a deal in that market on my own, or I could do a deal with you. I said, well, if you can go, I mean, either one's fine, but if you go do this deal on your own, remember, if it goes wrong, you signed on the loan.
Yeah.
Not me. So you're going down. So your exposure is not the $50,000 down payment. It's the $50,000 down payment plus the $100,000 of debt you're taking on as well that you could be liable for. When you do a syndication, we should be measuring, you know, risk based on leverage and debt, but also know that you're not signing on that debt. So that is one of the, I think people kind of overlook that, you know, and so I sign personally on these loans to do these deals. And I think a big benefit is that as an investor, you're not. Yeah, you might have to do, you know, there might be subjectivity to capital calls or you might lose your full investment, but you're not actually the one who's taking on the millions of dollars of risk necessarily.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You have principal risk, but you don't have downside loss risk necessarily where you're on the hook for if this thing goes upside down and the bank's chasing down the money they lent to, let alone the money you put in. So also I think like another thing that, you know, you can on this risk return and this, you know, is like if there's multiple assets in a fund, you know, that can decrease your risk because if there's five assets in there versus just one, there's less likelihood that they're all going to go bad. Maybe one of them has an issue, but the others can make up for it. But again, you can take that the other way to say, well, but if I just got the one that did really well, then, you know, so you can always like talk around this and make your point either way. I've seen people who raise money, both strategies, talk that through. But what the one you're investing into, understand their approach on that and have conviction around it, whatever it might be. It might be this is a one asset deal, but this is an incredible deal that you better have really high conviction for, as opposed to like a strategy where we're putting multiple assets in that I think I'm less interested in every single deal that you're doing in that because I understand the strategy and I feel like there's less risk because there's multiple assets in there.
Right.
More room for error, I guess.
I love that. And I want to move into this, but before we leave the debt piece, there's one other point I wanted to make. And that's actually as someone who puts deals together, you know, Ryan, you can attest to this as well. We will purposefully lever up or lever down based on the other risk factors of the deal. Like we bought 1300 acres for land entitlement in Colorado. Had we leveraged that deal, it would have been stupidly risky. There's no way. Yeah. So we bought it all cash because that way if delays happen.
It's not income producing, right?
No, it's not income producing. And so we didn't want to have to have a burn rate having debt on that property. So we were able to drastically reduce the risk profile on that deal by slamming the purchase to all cash. There are other deals where you're buying a stabilized multifamily or stabilized storage portfolio. It's completely responsible to put an appropriate amount of debt on that, especially if it's fixed rate. So I just wanted to make that point before we left the leverage conversation.
Yeah. One other tip I had, I was hit number two here. I don't know. Please. Well, I probably won't get through 10, but but I was like, this is like these are more like rule of thumbs here is when you're looking at a deal, try to understand like how the person, the GP or the operator, makes money. I think that's like a really good thing to get. And the mindset that I have as an investor is I want them to make money with me, not from me.
Absolutely.
And so I want to see that they really win when I win, you know, that their payments and I just want to see that alignment of interest there. A lot of funds that are sometimes like a debt fund or and those are the ones that sometimes it'll be more scary is like, I mean, you're really on the risk of this loans that they make good, but they're getting comped everywhere on the money they lend out on an AUM. And it's like, man, they can make a lot of money and I don't, you know? So I'm like, right. These, why we see it in JV deals and partnership deals all the time, where I'll ask, like, this is, again, we're not doing this as your self-directed IRA custodian, but lawyer Matt back in the day, I would look at it and be like, dude, you guys' interests are not aligned. Like your money's in here and they've already made money and you didn't. You're the one with all the risk on the upside.
Yeah. And the thing that I always like to add to that is one of the worst deals I ever did was the operator didn't take any fees.
Right.
They didn't collect anything. And so like the project took forever because he was actually physically doing the work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like,
because they don't have any money.
Because they don't have any money. Right.
So, exactly. Yeah.
So it's like,
yeah, it has to be a balance
for failure.
It has to be balanced.
I think there's like, you can go full, like this guy's taken every penny out of the profit to this guy isn't paying himself enough.
Yeah.
And he's not able to actually do anything productively because he's like managing. He's like in the, you know, the post hole digger and like down in the trenches, like trying to set the concrete on. You know, like you're not project managing this investment. Or you haven't hired somebody to do that and you're not overseeing it. And that's a recipe for disaster as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, like what I want to know is like, okay, I'm investing. You're making money with me. Hopefully the fund's structured like that. You know, when I make money, you're making money. And a lot of it, it's of course, like the big exit when the property sells, the portfolio sells, whatever it may be, is when I really, really make money. And hopefully the operator's making money too and is trying to get me there too. And they've got a carrot and incentive that that happens as well. But one thing I think some people, and I've had some people balk at this when they're looking at an investment, is they're like, hey, but their property management company manages the property. They're just paying themselves to manage it. Oh, hey, their construction company does that. Not sure I'm on that page on that one. Like, I'm just saying some of the best operators I've invested into are the ones that in-house that, but that's a cost of that. And so they're collecting a property management fee for, let's say, properties that they're managing. Now, I want to know like what that is and is that a reasonable fee? But the ones that are very well run, typically I shouldn't generalize this, but they have an understanding of the team that they work for. That they work with, and there's control on that. And so you need to make sure that when you're looking at that, I wouldn't necessarily walk away on that and be like, oh, they're just trying to make money off of me. This is what you said, Matt. They're paying their own property management or they're paying their own construction company. And I'm like, actually, that's a good thing sometimes.
I think Spartan is a perfect example of that, right? Because, you know, you have in-house property management. You have an entire separate company. You have an entire separate construction company in-house. And those are fees that would be paid to someone else had you not taken it in-house, right? So like, it's not like you're making the money versus the investors keeping it. That money has to be spent somewhere.
Yeah. And here's what's also, and I'll admit, you know, not every deal we've done has gone perfectly to plan. And what's really fun about having, not really fun, I shouldn't say, but really convenient to have when you're the property manager is we've actually killed fees on properties. So we said, hey, this property isn't going to pro forma. We're actually not going to take our property management fees to earn more income for the investors or better position the asset for the investors. And here's why this is a big deal. If I had hired a third-party property management company and I had gone to them and said, oh, hey, this isn't going as well as we thought in our projections, so we're going to go ahead and just ask you to waive your 6% or 5% property management fee. What do you think they're going to say to me? Yeah.
Good luck, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll do that. And we're leaving tomorrow. So there's some flexibility. And if you have an operator who's actually got that scale, where they can afford to do that and still keep a good team in place when they do that. Because that's the thing, is like, you can't just cut all your property management fees because you can't pay anybody, right? So it's still, anyway, I don't mean to spiral into that, but that is a really important thing, I think. And, you know, I've grown, that's my lived experience the last 10 years, is growing a construction company and a property management company that services our business. And by the way, they're completely separate companies with their own presidents and executives, you know, their own P&L. So it's a real, and they do third party services on our construction side, where we actually go build the self storages for other people as well. So, yeah.
What I would kind of summarize on this point is just like, when you're investing in a deal or a company, like, what is the team? Is this in-house? Is this people they have relationships with that are third-party contractors? That's fine. My companies, I have contractors too in certain roles versus, you know, in-house stuff. And so, but just understand who the team is that's going to be executing on this. Have they worked together for a while? Like, I think those are, that's another good thing to get concept on, because if I go back to the very first point, it's like, I want to understand the deal. What's their edge? What sets them apart? Why am I investing in them, and why they're going to be the ones that outperform everyone else trying to do what they're doing? And then, but then there's the team that's got to go execute on that. And I want to have good understanding of who that is.
I like it. What's next?
I would say two other things. I'll put these together and we can maybe wrap up on these two. Is three things. So I'll go fast on these. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Engage a lawyer to look out for your interests. Okay. If you're like, particularly if you're very inexperienced in this, you really don't need a lawyer for every deal. But like, especially if you're really new at this and you're throwing in a six-figure amount of money, you might want to hire a lawyer, spend a few hours to get some advice on this, who can actually look over the documents and talk through it with you. So, and a lot of times I'll have, and this is always a red flag for me, if you tell them, that whoever's, you know, raising capital on a deal and you're going to invest with them, they say, hey, I need my lawyer to review the documents, and they give you a hard time about that,
oof,
run.
Yeah.
Or if they say, yeah, oh, our lawyers have already looked at it, don't worry.
Oh, gosh.
Their lawyers have, okay? Those lawyers were not looking out for you. Yeah. So it's okay. Feel like, particularly when you're new at this, you should get some legal advice. Understand what you're getting into. This is an illiquid investment. How can I get out if I need to? Like, I think some people need that. They need that talking through. Now, you might be a super experienced business person or professional where you're, this is like, I know what I'm doing. I know how to kind of do this. And a lot of our clients are like these, even our law firm clients, you know, once they've done a few of these, they know how to vet them and look through them. The second thing is seek the opinion of a friend. So many times, like all of someone like, this is back going to lawyer, Matt, is they will call me and they'll start talking through the deal. And I can already tell they're like, oh, this kind of sounds dumb. Now that I tell it to my lawyer, right, they're like, this sounds crazy, you know? And they'll be like, I know it might sound. And I'm like, eh. I'm like, so you just wanted me to like bless this or throw some holy water on it? I'm like, those issues that you raised to me is the same problem I have with it sometimes. Right. But the fact of like verbalizing it sometimes like helps people. And this, again, it doesn't have to be with a lawyer. This could be with a friend, another business owner, investor, you know, spouse even. Sometimes depends on your spouse.
That's true.
Depends on your spouse.
That's true.
But someone that's maybe got some like perspective that you know, whether it's, I think like business owners, entrepreneurs, other investors are a good test for that because they've done it before. They might have some things to think about or some, ooh, I've done this wrong, would be that. And then the last one I would have is, and this is like the hardest one, is get comfortable saying no.
Yeah.
It's okay to say no. I know sometimes you make a relationship with someone, you like that person raising the capital, your friend invested in it, it's your sister's neighbor that you think, you know, I don't know, whatever it is. It's like, it's okay. Say no. If it doesn't feel right at the end of the day, or you don't believe in what they're doing, or that they're the ones that can execute on this strategy or whatever opportunity they have, it's okay to say no. And honestly, like the best investor clients, like the biggest accounts here, they say no more than they say yes. And so you have to get out there, look at other opportunities, and be ready and know that it's more likely you'll say no than say yes.
And recognize that there's always another opportunity.
Yes.
There's always another deal. You know, there are,
yes,
there's a million deals out there. It's just that your eyes are only on one right now, right? There's always going to be another deal.
I'll admit, like, my next self-storage deal is not the next Amazon opportunity. There'll be another one. And there'll be another one. And there'll be another one. If there is no rush to do anything stupid.
That's another thing. If someone's like, oh, you've got to invest now. This deal's going to go away. This is the incredible opportunity of a lifetime. Yeah. We've got to get your money in within 48 hours. I mean, that's like fraud. Usually I'm like, don't worry about that.
Well, Matt, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing your advice here. It was awesome seeing you at the event. How do people get in touch with you and follow along with all the great things that you're doing?
Yeah. So for any of you that are like, oh, this IRA thing piqued my interest, we've done a separate podcast episode on that. So you guys can check out that. Get over to directedira.com. You can learn more about what we're doing there. We have tons of educational resources. The altassetsummit.com, that's the website that has the recordings of the conference. Lots of other speakers, including the one and only Ryan Gibson was speaking there. Awesome presentation on self-storage. I was there. It was okay. Mine was okay. But
yours is great.
Yeah. And then if you go to @MattSorensen, that's where I'm at on YouTube mostly. I am trying to do some YouTube. So I've got a lot of educational content on YouTube. So I'm out there. I'm easy to find. Matt with one T, M-A-T.
Awesome.
And that was episode 124. If you want to go back, we talked about the future of retirement investing and all about alternatives back in episode 124. So check it out. That was with Matt Sorensen. Lastly, if people do want to maybe roll over a TSP or roll over a self-directed existing IRA, again, if you want to learn more about IRA investing, we've had episodes in the past where we've talked all about the nuances of what you can roll, what you can't. But if somebody's interested in rolling over one of these accounts, how can they do so?
Yeah, just get over to directedira.com. You can just open up an account online, or you can book a call with our team if you need help. You've got questions. They've been doing this all day. We've got an experienced and amazing team that can help you along the way. So let us know if we can be a resource for you. And it was an honor to be on. Two-time guest. I'm feeling pretty special.
That's right.
On the pod.
I love it. Yeah. And by the way, if you're listening to this and you don't want to reach out to Directed IRA initially, Tate and I have conversations with people all the time about the ins and outs and how to do this, or Ted or TJ on Tate's team.
Absolutely.
So if you want to get the rundown and kind of learn more about it too before you make the leap over there, that's a very normal course of action for a lot of pilots.
Absolutely.
But if you're ready to go,
great point.
You know, check it out.
We'll link to that in the show notes. Matt, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Matt.